Hi, I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
Welcome to Season 3 of Stages Podcast,
where we continue to bring creation and connection to center stage.
Yeah, we're sitting over here.
I saw one peek kind of pop in through the mirror. Yeah.
I did too.
That's Ayo Tunde. Say hello. Come say hello.
Hello.
Oh, hello, handsome. Hello, gorgeous human. How are you?
Cute boy, right?
Look how proud she is of you.
My heart.
Hi, everybody. We have a theater icon with us today. She is a Tony and Emmy Award winner and has worked for more than four decades in Broadway shows like How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, Dreamgirls, Once on This Island, Chicago, Barnum, and more. She won her Tony Award for her portrayal of Sonia, a role that was written for her in the musical The Life. She is featured in the Disney animated film Hercules as Calliope, and she is currently starring in Hadestown as Hermes. Her album, Get Yourself Some Happy, is available now, and we will put a link to that in the bio. This woman is a force of nature, and we are so happy because we know she has recently just celebrated her 72nd birthday, and we are so honored to have her here with us. Please welcome the incredible Lilias White.
Lilias White, to stage, please. Lilias, can we have you to stage?
Hello.
Hi. Yay. Glad to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. I want to talk a little about your birthday.
Was it a good one?
What did you
do? It
was
so sweet. Well, I had a show that night, but my cast and crew, there were cakes, two cakes, and there was ice cream, and there was You know, we have a on this next to the sign up, the sign in sheet on the call board. There's a list of people's birthdays and what kind of cake they want.
Oh, specific.
So I put down German chocolate cake. Mm. And then on the side, I put down fried chicken, collard greens, potato salad. But I was joking. Well, I want you to know there was fried chicken, potato salad, collard greens, and mac and cheese. And it was so delicious.
Oh, good.
And they brought me gifts and I got flowers. My dressing room was right now filled with flowers.
And you love it. Do you usually receive your birthday like that? You want the bells and whistles, the celebration, or do you like kind of a quieter enter into a new year?
Well, sometimes I want quiet, but generally I'm usually doing a show on my birthday.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm not in a Broadway show, I usually do a cabaret show somewhere on my birthday. But this time I was in the show and it was just spectacular. I got beautiful earrings to wear and the flowers, and it was great.
You felt loved.
I do feel loved. I do.
Good.
How do you feel about 72? How does that feel, that number?
72 feels great. The only thing is that my knees hurt.
Mm.
My knees hurt, and I took a fall, stage left a few weeks ago. So that side of me hurts a little bit. But I'm in PT, and I feel like I'm so blessed to be able to do 8 shows a week at this age. There's a lot of people that I grew up with who they can't do this.
My mom is an octogenarian. I'm not exactly allowed to say her exact age, but she's a wonder. She's remarkable. She drives, she tango dances, she is a docent at a museum. She never stops moving. And like my grandfather, who lived to be 103, she just said, you just keep moving. You just keep doing. You just get up every day and you pick something to do and you just go and do it. But
I
used to love like the big birthday celebration stuff. Like, so for me, it was like, bring it on, more presents, make it last a week. But then I heard Prince say something.
And
I love Prince. I mean, I don't often get sad when celebrities pass. But when Prince passed, I was really sad because he was like my youth. He said he never celebrated a birthday because he said, you only have one birthday, the day you were born. And the practice of celebrating birthdays forces you to count years, which forces you to count time. And time is an illusion. So if you don't count time, it doesn't really pass. And that's why he said he looked, I mean, he looked really young.
Yeah, you're right.
He never changed. And he said, that's why I never change, because I refuse to count time, because I think it's a man-made construct. Isn't that awesome?
Wow.
So then I was like, well, maybe I won't count birthdays. But then, Lilias, I really like presents. So I don't know.
And pretty earrings and balloons.
Yeah, all of that. Oh, and they sang to me. It was great. It was great. I love it. I love it. I love celebrating anybody's birthday.
And you know what? Any day you can search out joy. That's probably one of the reasons I too, like Christmas is big. All of the Easter's big, Halloween's big, because if you can find joy in this world and actually cultivate it on your own, why the hell not? Do it. You had a show last night as well.
Yeah. What day is it?
Today is Friday.
Yes. We had a show last night.
Yeah.
What day is it?
You're coming close to the end of your contract as well.
No, honey, I've been extended to February.
Tell me how you feel. Do you feel like there's more to be mined in the story and more to share, or the people are just receiving it with so much open heart that you're like, let's keep telling it?
I got to tell you, I'm really enjoying it.
Good.
I'm really enjoying it. It's a great cast, a wonderful crew. My dresser is just an angel.
Oh, that's a big thing. Yeah.
So my stage manager, I just feel really taken care of and loved and appreciated. And it's not a killer show for me. You know, I don't have, 12, 11 o'clock numbers, and it's taxing, but I'm adjusting. Yeah, I'm back in PT, but my old knees, honey, my old knees. Oh, baby. Yeah.
I want to know something, and we're going to go back. Why did you start in this business? What led you here, and why did you start?
Well, it kind of picked me. When I was little, my grandmother used to have big dinners every Sunday, soup to nuts, homemade everything, homemade ice cream. So after the dessert, my grandfather, who had to wash the dishes all every day, my grandmother said, okay, clear the table. My baby's going to sing a dance. And they put me up on the dining room table, and I would sing a dance. My aunt Lilias was a dancer with the June Taylor Dance Company that was on the Jackie Gleason show.
Oh, wow, Lilias.
Yeah, so I got to see my Aunt Lilias in her costumes, top hats, and, all that tutus and stuff like that. And so she kind of encouraged me. She was my mother's youngest sister, and my mother really helped raise her. But when I came along, my mother had me late in life, and so I was the baby. And so I had this thing. I used to just love to sing and dance and move around. And so anyway, by the time I got to college, I knew that I wanted to be a dancer, but there were no ballet schools. I wanted to be a ballerina, but there were no ballet schools for Black girls in my neighborhood or anywhere. And so I took a dance class instead of, they changed the New York City curriculum so that instead of taking a gym class, you can have a dance class. So I took all the dance classes I could take. By the time I got to college, I was into the music more. And I thought I was going to be a big pop star. So I'm in a music class. I'm singing this. I'm trying to sight read, which I still don't do very well.
I don't either. Let's be honest. I don't either.
I'm terrible.
I learned with the ear,
Me too. Me too.
So I in the sight reading class, and the teacher says to me, I want to see you after class. And I thought, oh shit.
I'm out.
I messed it up. So she told me that she liked my voice and she wanted me to come into audition for a theater company that she and her husband had founded. This theater company was called The Demigods. And our credo was every singer was a dancer and as an actor. So I get to this thing, I audition, they let me in. I knew nothing about how to act. I could sing and I could dance, but acting, I didn't really have a clue about it. So I was really bad. I was so bad until, I was asked, just get off the stage. I would forget my lines. I would forget where I was. We did a production of Antigone Africanus.
Oh.
And, yeah, and I was Antigone, and it was three acts. And I started doing the show, and the next thing you know, I'm singing the lines for the third act. I totally screwed it up. It's awful.
But if I can interject, if they're trusting you with playing Antigone, you have to have something magical and star power in you for them to even entrust you with that role in this piece, right?
Well, but I didn't believe it. I didn't know. I didn't know what I had. I really did not know what I had. I didn't know what people felt when they heard me singing. Mm-hmm. And I know better now, and I don't shoot for that, but I didn't know then. I had no idea what it was I had. So they put me in this thing, and eventually, we had mentors come in. We had master classes come in with really prominent Black actors like Francis Foster. And we had a dance class, master classes with Johnny Green, and, really significant people. I stayed with the theater company close to 7 years. And then I went out and started auditioning. And the first thing I auditioned for was something at the New York Theater Workshop.
Yeah.
It was a show called Soledad Tetrad. And they were looking for someone to play the Djinn of Sin. Uh-huh. And they wanted someone who could sing, dance, and act. Well, I had just been trained exclusively to do that. So I went in there and I say, I am the Djinn of Sin. And I was doing all this crazy movement and dancing all around. And they were like, oh, yes, you. So I did that. I got my first review in the Village Voice.
How old were you at this point? Like 25 or so?
I was like 24, 25, something like that.
Yeah,
that would be interesting to find that review, because it was great. It was a rave.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, it was a rave review. So I did that show. And then somehow there were people in the audience who had me come and audition for different things. And one of the things I auditioned for was a production of the Amen Corner. So I was going to be in the chorus of this show. And the woman who was in the part that I eventually got couldn't do it. And they said, well, let her do it. So I'm in the Amen Corner and I'm doing this little role, a little tiny thing. And I'm singing a little whatever I sang. And the producers for the Wiz Buster Truck Company were in the audience. And they asked the producer for that show. They said, well, who is she? They said, oh, she's Lilias White. And, she's really young and she's new. And I said, well, we want her to come and audition for the Wiz Buster Truck. Mm-hmm. So I went to audition for the Wiz Buster Truck. And then I went to audition for another Broadway show that was a brand new show that was being directed and choreographed by George Faison. But somehow word got to me that they wanted me to come and do the Wiz Buster Truck. I went into the first day of rehearsal, and there was George Faison, Geoffrey Holder, my love. George Faison says to me, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm the Dorothy understudy. And he said, well, he was really flustered. He said, I was going to put you in the other show. So I had booked two shows that week. I did the Wiz Bustin' Truck. I went on, I did the Collie Daz, and I did all the chorus stuff, the Winged Monkeys, and I was a dancer. And it was great. Long story short, I ended up taking over the role of Dorothy. I didn't have an agent when all this was going down. There was a contest in South Carolina, and the girl who won the contest was going to be awarded the role of Dorothy.
Oh, this is like reality shows before reality shows.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
So when the seniors in the company found out that the producers were planning on keeping me as the understudy and put this girl in the role, and now, mind you, I had been on as Dorothy all around the country on the bus. I'd been on. And I'd save their asses a lot of times when that girl would show up. The seniors in the company said, this is not right. You've been doing this role, and you should have the opportunity to be in the role. They said, call your agent. I said, I don't have an agent. Brett Freeman said, I have an agent, and you're going to call her tomorrow, and she's going to help you. It was Honey Saunders. Honey Saunders was a big, brassy, deep-throated, kind of redhead, fabulous woman. And she called the producers of the Wiz Bustin' Truck, and she said, my client has been saving your asses all over America. And I want you to give her that role. I know the role's available and you better put her in the role. And they said to her, oh, we didn't know she had an agent.
And that changed the conversation all of a sudden.
Changed the conversation. Because they were counting on that. They were counting on this little girl. I didn't know nothing. All I know was I could do it. And I loved it. And so anyway, that's how I got the role of Dorothy. And that led to getting the understudy role in Ain't Misbehavin'. And I went on tour with that for a while and then discovered I was quite pregnant.
I just discovered.
I bet that's a story.
Yeah. So anyway, I stayed with that. I was the understudy for the Charlene role, which is the dancing role. And we were in Canada, and my brother and my sister came up to visit me. I said, don't you notice anything different about me? And they said, well, you look really great. Your skin, your energy's great. So I pulled back the robe I had on and showed them the belly, and they were gagging. And they said, you're pregnant? And I said, yeah, I'm pregnant. They said, well, you have to come home right now. I said, I can't come home. I can't just leave the show. Yeah, but you can't be doing all that we just saw you doing. That kicking and stomping and scrapping and all that stuff you're doing. You're pregnant. I said, I'm fine. The doctor says I'm fine. No, you have to come home. So that was about 2 months, so three, 2.5 months after that, when I had gone to the doctor and he gave me an exam, and I said I was having these pains, and he said it's Braxton Hicks contractions, and it's time for you to come off that stage. Mm. So I said, well, I can't come right now because I haven't saved enough money. And anyway, I got a maternity girdle, and I stayed another month. I didn't tell anybody, so nobody knew I was pregnant. Management didn't know. And the wardrobe people kind of suspected because they kept happening to take my costume out every time.
Little by little.
Yeah. And so anyway, I left the show. They said, come back anytime you want. You're great. You're great. And I came home and I had my baby. I didn't stay with her father because he's out of his mind. Mm-hmm. And I had to buck up and figure out how I was going to continue with my life.
Yeah. So you're in your late 20s, a single mom.
I'm in my late 20s. Yeah.
A single mom in this business, which is so precarious and hard to foresee a future in anyway. So that's a scary time.
And at that time, being a single mom and not married was not very popular.
Yeah. Mm. Did your parents accept it? Were they furious? What was that whole scene?
My mother was kind of upset with me because she didn't like him. Mm. And she always said to me, Lily, if you're going to be in this business, you shouldn't have children.
Yeah, I know. That's the narrative. That's the script we all hear.
And I didn't want to live that way. I wanted to have a full life. I always wanted to have kids. But then at 16, I discovered the disco, and I had good grades, and my mother let me go on Thursday nights to Latin night to dance, and I went to the disco on the weekends, and I had beautiful clothes, and she said, you like these clothes? You like going to that club?
That don't have children.
Don't have no babies in here. Don't bring no babies in here.
It's always about figuring it out. It doesn't matter whether it's moving an apartment, having a child, starting a new business. I mean, it's this state of being is always assessing, reassessing, and trying to figure it out. So like you said, your whole goal was to have a full life. So whether it was going to happen in your 20s or your 30s, that baby was going to come because it was, in your divine plan that you wanted a full life.
Yes.
And I think what happens is what we were saying earlier, like about Prince, how so many of the things that we're supposed to do are these constructs that are just handed down to us that are
man-made
made up
constructs.
By some, whether it's a religious order or some, what suits someone else. And then we think that this is how you're supposed to do things. And I think that's so limiting. And it feels like the younger generation is taking that to a different level. They're sort of like, don't tell me I'm supposed to have a home. I'm going to do the van life for a while. And I think they kind of have a clearer view. They don't fall for the, this is how things are supposed to be. I mean, when I was growing up, I'm a bit younger than you, Lilius, but I grew up in the kind of house where I was told girls don't move out till they get married.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how it was. And I didn't ever question it. My girlfriend's fathers were Italian and they said the same things. And then I went to college and I was like, oh, that's not true. And so I think you don't know what you don't know until you get out in the world and start questioning things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And follow your gut and follow your heart.
That's right.
And, if I didn't learn anything in the theater company that I was in, it was to learn how to follow your gut, because your instincts are 99.9% correct.
You have this incredible gift of almost bending the character to your will so that the marriage is more you. And I hope you take this as it's intended, which is a massive compliment, but you infuse yourself in that character. Mm. Even now, the reinvention of that role in Hadestown, no one could foresee, because only you could do what you're doing. Have you always done that? I guess you have, because even your audition story was like, I'm the Jennison. You know, it wasn't, I'm going to sing a song that kind of fits the part. I am going to bring you the part the way I'm going to meet it. And then it's contagious. They fall in love with you. And there it is.
It's hysterical, Stephanie. I literally wrote the same question. I was like,
you did.
You make everything uniquely you. No one else can do what you do. And every song and every part is that way. And my question was, how do you find that unique fearlessness that you bring to everything I've ever seen or heard?
I don't know. How do I do it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I take a deep breath. I look at the material. I find how it relates to me and my life and what I've done and who I am and what I've been through. And I just breathe. Oh. I don't know how to
it
tell
just
you
comes
how
out.
To do that, but you do that. We all do that. All of us who get on the stage and create a character or take over a character, we all do that. I can't tell you in words how it's done. There's no formula. I study hard and I try to just make it as authentic and as I can.
And you never second guess it. You know, when once you do it, do you ever go, oh, geez, why did I do that? Like,
oh,
even
yeah.
The way you said,
oh,
we
yeah.
are the muses, you know, and you're Hercules,
yes.
The way you do, we are the muses. I don't know. I would never have the guts to just like go in and totally be myself. I think maybe now at this stage in my life, I would. But I think when I was in my early years in the business, I was so busy worrying about what they wanted.
Of course.
And delivering them what they wanted rather than just going in and being like, this is me. And this is how I'm going to say this line. And I admire it immensely. I wish I had more courage to just do that.
Well, I also use as an example people that I'm really enamored and have great respect for. For instance, We Are the Muses came from the idea that I was Felicia Rashad.
Oh, and Felicia, really?
And if Felicia Rashad would say this, she would say, we are the muses. Keepers of the play, whatever that line is. And so I look at it that way. I try to emulate people that I think are fantastic. Just not to copy what they do, but just to get the flavor of how they would do something.
Mm-hmm.
And with Hermes, you know, being a mother and a grandmother, I have 8 grandkids.
Do you really? Now, do you gather with your family? Do you still gather for like Sunday night meals or Monday meals? Oh, drats.
I have not done that. I'm always working.
Yeah.
And 5 of my grands are in Las Vegas.
Okay.
And the other 3 here, I don't get to see them as often as I'd like to. But I'm planning something for Christmas and I'm hoping it's going to work.
Yeah, I know.
But have some of them come from Las Vegas and have this crew over here.
Yeah, 2 children.
I have a son and a daughter. Yeah. My daughter is, I shouldn't tell you her age, but she's 43. And my son is 37, and he's the one with the 5 kids in Las Vegas.
Wow.
Did they follow into the artsy-fartsy world?
My daughter has somewhat, but I think that for both of them, they've seen the ups and downs of it.
Yeah.
And so they have not fully embraced it and gone to school and done all that stuff.
The first line of your Tony speech was love brought me here tonight. So I want to talk a little bit about love being the driving force in your life and your spirituality, which I think is very easy to see when you talk to you. You just seem like a really grounded person who has strong roots in spirituality. Do you want to talk a little about what that practice is for you?
Well, the love that I referred to in the Tony speech was the love of my grandmother my parents, especially my aunts and uncles, who saw something in me, and they encouraged me and they applauded me and they made me feel like I could do anything. My spiritual practice is that of an African religion. It's called the Yoruba religion. In the States and in some of the other parts of the world, it's called Santeria.
Oh, sure.
And it is something that has kept me alive, helped me take care of my health, take care of my mental health. I feel like I am grounded in that. There are other aspects of my life, though, that are not so grounded. I remember a company manager told me years and years ago, save your money. And I didn't. I like to shop. I like to spend money. I like to make it and I like to spend it. But I'm grounded in that I know that there are good people in the world. I know that there are bad people, but I think that there are more good than bad. And I tend to look for that in everyone and see that in people. Everybody has the things they're working on in themselves. And I can consider myself a work in progress in that respect. So I'm grounded in the fact that I want to be of good character. That is essential to me, to be of good character. That's more important than having money and having, you know, nice rubies and whatever, and having lots of friends. It's to be of good character. And that is what I strive for all the time.
I'm with you. With the result of people, you know, perfection we know is unattainable. I look for people that are just doing the best they can wherever they are in their walk of life. Now I get a little hesitant and I start to retract from certain people when I see that they have just, again, the word choice may not be right, but settled, or they have stopped working toward the better of them or the better of the world. They've just stopped. So they're no longer doing the best they can. And that to me is when it seems a little precarious, a little dangerous, and I step back. But it doesn't matter at what point you are in your journey, as long as you just keep working toward the next right thing, the next step, then I feel safe. Yeah. Then I can recognize in people the good.
Well, let me ask you, Steph, when you come across those people that you feel, I mean, I think there's good and bad in everyone. And yes, course. It's about self-awareness and it's about, like you said, character. Like what do I want my character to be and how do I want people to receive me?
Yes.
So when you come across someone who has stopped doing the work and who is stuck in really negative patterns and it does start to affect you and you back away, do you feel guilty about leaving? About holding firm to your boundaries?
Because I won't cut ties, just it won't be a cold cutoff, right? So I also believe in this, which I have to constantly tell myself, unsolicited advice is criticism. So I wait until I am invited to someone's life to say, I need your help, or what do you think? Up till that point, I am a listener. I try to be a sounding board that I carry as much love as I can, but until I'm welcomed into their challenge or their obstacle, I just lovingly pay attention. Then I will offer, have you tried this? Can you reflect on this? You know, more positive as opposed to, I see you not doing this. I think you should do this, because I've learned that grown adults, you can't tell them what to do. It's just never going to work. But you can offer another avenue toward a different way of looking at things. Then when I release them, when I see that the complacency is not changing, they've just, this is where they are, then no, I don't feel guilty. I bless them on their journey from far, far away. I will hold them in my heart space and think about them. But I don't believe, if, again, we'll go back to that instincts, right? If our belly is saying, you now continuing to walk through life with them or to put yourself in their, I don't know, in their space. Here. And it doesn't, it does, you're not getting fulfilled from it. It's not feeding you in any way. It's actually
not helping them.
You. That's right. It's not helping them. It's not helping you.
That's right.
And why double down on a mistake? So at a certain point, you have to say, this is costing me. Every time I leave this person, I'm at a deficit. I have to release them. And no, I won't hold guilt if in a full-hearted way, I have tried my best to see them, to see their better angels or to see a better choice, and they don't see it. They can't see it.
I do feel guilty because at some point, you know, that person may have helped me on my journey. But when I see that they're not moving in a direction that's going to benefit them, you know, for instance, I have a friend who smoked and heavily drank for years, had a career, was working all the time, really great actress. but she wouldn't stop smoking and she wouldn't stop drinking. And now she's got serious health issues. Mm. I can't help. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a physician. I'm not a therapist. And I'm not a millionaire.
Yeah.
So I can't help. And I also have to keep going, keep my machine going. So there's a little bit of guilt in there, but I got to push past that and keep doing what it is I need to do.
Because sometimes, and even along the way, even before she had health issues, helping too much only perpetuates the problem. You're supporting the bad behavior by helping and helping. You know, I have some people in my life that, you know, I keep at bay. I have no choice because it's a very unhealthy situation. And I always come back to what Andre Deshields said in his Tony speech. For our listeners, Andre Deshields was in the role in Hadestown before Lilias took it over. And he said, I be with people whose eyes light up
when you enter a room. That's right.
And so I try to be that for people. And I notice now if the people are that for me. And when they're not, I definitely have in my 50s decided, like, you know what? You don't get to be with me because your eyes don't light up. you don't see what I put out, and or maybe you see it and you don't like it, and that's okay. But
that's okay too.
Yeah. And I just I've really learned in this decade of my life to like move past that kind of stuff. And I do sometimes suffer with guilt, especially when it has to do with like family members or stuff. But I also have a policy that if they came to me and asked humbly for help or for forgiveness to move forward in a real way, I would. Right.
Yeah. Right.
But it's on, you have to put it on them.
At a certain point you do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even with my children, there's been a lot of drama with my children. And, you know, I've helped and I've tried to help and I've interfered. And now I have gone, said, hands up. And, you know, you're grown up and you're on your own and you got to figure it out.
It's a real fine line between enabling and loving. I mean, really, it and those lines can be blurred.
True. Yeah. That's very true. Yeah. Especially when you really care.
Especially when you really care. For sure. For sure. But if you're doing your best, I'll walk alongside you all the way to the final day.
Lilias, how did you end up doing the role of Hermes in Hadestown?
I was sitting here at this table several months ago with my friend Susan, and we were talking, just chatting, and we were talking about how Andre Deshields was leaving Hadestown. And Susan says to me, you know, you'd be great in that role. And I said, that's a man's role. It's a man playing the role. She said, yeah, but you'd be great at that. And I said, oh, Susan, come on. Just say you should call your agent. So we're in the moment. I said, okay, I'll call my agent. I called my agent. I said, Steve, my friend here thinks that I'd be a good replacement for Andre Deshields in Hadestown. Crickets. Crickets. And then he says, Lil, that's a great idea. He calls the powers that be in Hadestown. He says that to them. What do you think about Lilias White replacing Andre Deshields? Crickets. And then they said, that's a great idea. And so the wheel started turning. I didn't even audition. The wheel started turning. The thing got put together. It was out of the blue completely. Yeah.
And that's divine. When somebody says yes, and then this works, and then this works, and the contract comes, and the opening date is going to fit perfectly. And that's when you're like, that was mine. That there was nothing I could do to not have that be my next step.
Except not make that phone call. Except not say yes.
But I still believe, even if she didn't make the phone call, somebody would go, Lilias White. Like, it would have come a different way. Now, I love that it was taken. You don't?
No, I think all destiny is a mixture of inspiration and action.
Okay.
There was the inspiration and she took action. And that's why her destiny fell into place. That's what I believed. I always say this. How many of those little things pop into our life that we don't take action on? And where would you be had you said yes? I think that the reason it is because you took action. You're like, all right, and even if it was sort of like, oh, this is ridiculous, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then look it. Now it's yours. else can we dream up for you? Let's go pick up the phone.
Is there another one percolating?
Well, I don't know. I'm looking at scripts and not just for musicals, which is, you know, something that I've always wanted to focus on because a lot of people think I'm a musical theater person, which I am. But I also love doing straight plays. mm-hmm. or plays with music. But I want the strike to be over. Mm. I want this film and TV business to get its stuff together.
Get it together. You know, I just saw together, last
treat
night.
People right.
Netflix just put out an ad to hire an AI specialist for $900,000. So while actors, real human flesh and blood, are out there striking, saying, just give us a living wage so we can have, you know, medical and pay for our living. Nope, nope, that's not realistic. Can't do that. Can't do that. And then they put out an ad to say, here's a job for $900,000.
Wow.
It's disgusting.
Very poor taste.
That's right. It's saying we don't care about humanity. Wow. All we care about is the bottom line and getting
money.
Things done and getting it done quickly.
Money.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Horrible.
Horrible. It's going to be a little while, but I want the strike to be over, but I definitely want us to get to the table and find a way that we can still make a livelihood while yes. we're creating these stories for these
and
people.
And a decent livelihood. So
a
that it's
decent
hand
livelihood.
Them out, hand them out. You know, yeah. it's not fair for someone to sit in a suit in an office and make $1 billion.
Right.
And then you have people who are on the set every day working 12, 15
hours a day
to create something to entertain the masses. And these people are sitting in suits, you know, in a fancy office and making money and then dictating that this is unrealistic
yeah,
to them.
We don't deserve.
We want to be able to eat. We're not asking for a house in Malibu with a pool.
We
just want to be able to pay for what we have and live comfortably, at least
That's
be
right.
able to send our kids to school and have a decent running car and a nice place to live.
Yep. And I know these suits have to exist, but they don't need to make 9-10 figures.
They
you know what
not.
I mean? They don't.
No, they don't. They
so,
really don't.
I'm with you. I am yeah. with you. Why do I see
anyway,
you like
so
doing
I
Shakespeare?
Want
I want you to do Shakespeare and Shakespeare in the Park.
Could
you imagine
that.
Her taking the stage and saying Shakespeare's words outside at the public? Are you kidding me?
Call I would agent. Love that. I'm waiting for them to call me. They haven't called me.
They
Pick up your phone.
You.
Tell your agent to call them.
Listen, you know what else I was thinking about when I heard that they were doing Funny Girl?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody interviewed me to say, what do you think about the new Funny Girl, the revival of Funny Girl? I said, nobody's called me. And I'm from Brooklyn. I can give you an accent. You want a Jewish accent?
You can
I've got it for you.
You can do
I
it.
I can sing that. I've been singing that Barbra Streisand, all that stuff, all my whole life already.
Yes. Yes. Lilias, when did you step on stage for Hadestown? Was it September the 6th? Was
September that your... 6th, I think.
Yeah. Yes, because that it was a big hubbub because on September 6th, Lilias Michel went on for Funny Girl. You stepped into Hadestown. We stepped in for Into the Woods. Like it was a big shift. And it was like, which show are you going to be at that night? And I felt like, I made it. I'm in the same breath as these artists and people are deciding. And then, you know, that show was sold out. That show was sold out. But it's like, where were you on September the 6th?
Wow. Wow.
It was a special night for, I hate to say replacements because I never feel like I'm replacing. I'm just re-embodying or reimagining or, you know, but not necessarily.
So it was a good
replace.
Night for reimagining.
It was.
Yeah,
it really
they
was.
They should not say replacements anymore. They should say reimagining.
Somehow
yeah.
it feels a little more elevated yeah. than just replacing.
Well, I was yeah. wondering why they weren't reimagining Funny Girl with me.
I'm sorry.
Okay. But you know, as much progress as we've made in actors' equity and in the theater and in the show business, we still kind of stuck in things.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. And so, you know, hopefully one day maybe somebody will hear this podcast and say, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. I could be a Jewish mother.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about Fanny Rice at this age, but I can certainly, you want a Jewish mother.
All right, they'll put you right in there. Are you kidding? Wait, is it still running? It is still running.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
so I think
running,
it, yeah. What about you, Mary Lee? There are no binary understandings of anything. You would step into... what role? What would you want to play?
It's Kimberly Akimbo.
Oh,
I want to be Kimberly. I'm perfect for her. Perfect.
Oh, that's great.
For her. Yeah.
First thing that came to my head is I want to be George Washington in Hamilton. I want to be the mother of this country. Here comes the general. Here comes the general. I could do
that.
Really I would strut on so sexily and with so much power, so much energy.
I don't think I'd want to be him, though. I want to be the king.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
All right, producers, we are giving you oodles of ideas.
We are telling you what's up. You know, open your eyes, open your minds.
Can I ask you what it was like to work with Cy Coleman?
Cy Coleman was so much fun.
Oh.
He was so much fun. And he loved me.
I bet he did.
And I felt that every time I was in his presence. He was funny. His eyes lit up.
Mm-hmm.
He was fun. He was funny. He was stern.
Okay.
And he was open to the fact that I could come on and sing Sonia the same way, but differently each time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times when he would, oh God, I got chills.
Mm.
He and Shelby, his beautiful wife, would come and come to the theater just in time to hear me do The Oldest Profession. Get full just talking about it. And then I'd come off stage and said, oh, you're a force of nature, Lilias. He would call me that. But he loved good food. He loved good wine. He had millions of stories to tell. He had these little hands. They were short fingers. But somehow he was able to reach around on that keyboard and make the most incredible music. And my fondest memories of him are him playing for me as he's playing here and he's looking up at me from the piano. I loved him.
And did you know him before you worked together in that show?
Yeah, because I did Barnum on Broadway.
Oh, that's right. Wow.
Of course.
Yes. I reimagined Joyce Head.
Reimagined. There it is.
The Oldest Woman Alive on Barnum. And my audition for Barnum was crazy too. They had auditions at the theater during that time. This was 1981. Joe Layton, Cy Coleman, Rhoda Dreskinoff. They were all in the dark back of the theater. And I sang Don't Rain on My Parade.
There it is.
That was my audition song back then. And then they said, okay, you know any circus skills? And I had just done an all-female production of Waiting for Godot with all women in clown suits and makeup, clown costumes and makeup. And I had to learn how to juggle to do that. So I had learned how to juggle. So I thought, I got to juggle, you know. They gave me the little beanbag.
It's impressive.
So I started juggling. And I hadn't done it in a while, so I was kind of out of practice. And the bag kept falling on the floor. I jumped on it, fell on the floor. And I finally picked them up and I said, well, it gets better. And they were hysterical. They thought that was really funny. They said, don't worry about it. You got the job.
Oh,
and
they told
me on the spot that I got the job. And so after that, I loved Cy Coleman. I was familiar with his music, very familiar with his music, way before I met him. And then when my mother met him, the night of the Tonys, my whole family just surrounded him. We all loved him so much because he was loved and he was fun and he was the epitome of great music. And he wasn't selfish with it.
Yeah.
He was very open and gracious and appreciative of the fact that you could sing his stuff, but he was stern about how he wanted it done. And I miss him terribly.
What do you think happens when a person passes on? Do you think there's heaven or do you think that they're still with us and there's just a veil between us and them? What's your perception of what's next?
My perception is that we leave the body, but our spirits, our souls, there's a presence. I believe that the spirits are there to watch over us and to guide us and protect us. My belief system involves very much dealing with the ancestors, ancestor worship, ancestor care.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an altar in your home for your ancestors?
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. Yeah,
I do too.
Does. Yeah.
I do too. Yeah. Yeah.
And I hit the stick and I talk to them and I say, okay, what am I supposed to do with this?
I went to a reading.
Okay.
We sat down and he said to me, your ancestors are upset with you. And I said, why? And he said, okay, let me tell you it this way. Let's pretend on the other side of that door, there's $10 million. And I say to you, all you have to do is get through that locked door to get your $10 million. What are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I'll take the hinges off. I'll pull the door off. And he said, no. If you had your eyes open, you'd see your ancestors are standing there with the key. He goes, but you're not talking to them. They're all there and you're not talking to them. He goes, you go home and you build an altar for your ancestors. And you tell them that you are listening and things will happen. And I was like, oh my God. So I have an altar right here, right in my, it's right next to me. Candles are lit. When he said that, it resonated with me. I was like, oh my God, he's like, you're not on your own. It's not all about you doing this on your own. They're all here to support you, and you have to acknowledge that they're with you.
Yes.
I was like, oh, I'm going home and acknowledging. So that was, it was an amazing experience. He actually wanted to kill a chicken while I was in the room, and I pleaded with him, please don't kill a chicken, please. I can't. The
is that part of Santeria? I feel like there are.
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, please don't. You can't kill a chicken in front of me.
Darling, listen, sacrifice the chicken so that you are not the sacrifice.
Yeah, but why is the chicken's life worth less than mine?
It's not about the work. Your life is worth a lot. That's why the chicken is giving its life to save you.
I couldn't do it. I said, you got to think of something else I can do. I can't kill a chicken. He was like, okay, I'll give you something else to do. He thought I was crazy. But that was a really wild experience. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience.
If you went to the same person I'm thinking of, he is an amazing person.
In the Bronx?
No.
Okay, different.
No, different. No. Yeah, it was awesome.
All right, we've arrived at the five questions. But just before, a word from our sponsors. If we were to call your family and say that you were put in prison, okay, you've done something, what would your family assume you've done to land yourself in jail?
Oh, God. Hit somebody on the head with a machete. I don't know. Ayo.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
I would want to know how to read, write, speak, in every language and dialect on the planet.
I've never heard that one.
That's a good one.
Love that one.
Is there anything in your closet, a garment or a piece of jewelry that you will never get rid of because of the memories it holds?
I have a lot of stuff. I have a fur coat that I haven't had for a long time, but it reminds me of the first fur coat that I got from my best friend's mother, from Cookie's mother. Mm. It was a mink paw coat. It was gorgeous, like a gold color. That coat and my mother's big beaver coat reminded me to always stay warm. And I learned from my mother how to take care of myself. And I don't know why the fur coat is coming up.
That's the thing.
But that's the thing that it keeps me warm. It makes me feel secure. Yeah.
In the book of your life, what is this chapter called?
This chapter is called, You Are Free to Move Around the World.
Nice.
You are free. You are free. You have everything that you need to live well. You know everything you need to know already. And all you have to do is do it. Say yes.
Love it.
I love it. All right. I hope this one doesn't stump you. It may, but we ask every single guest this question. If you were a nail polish color, what color would it be? And what's the cheeky little name of that nail polish?
It would be silver and gold, and it would be called the greatest star.
Yes, that's fabulous. All right, you greatest star, go about your day. We honor you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for this.
I had so much fun talking to you.
Such a joy.
Be well.
You
Take
too.
Good care.
Okay, the chapter of her life was the whole book, and I love it. You're free. You're free to travel the world. You're free to do what's next. Just say yes, you're free.
With
Go
her nail
do
polish
it.
Color, I had to stop myself because you know how I love to blurt out everybody's name for them.
I know you do.
It's Freebird.
But greatest star is pretty great. With silver and gold. Yeah, pretty great.
That was pretty good.
It's interesting about Santeria. My mother growing up, she was born and raised in East LA, and my grandfather owned a little motel. And those that helped service the hotel, they too, that was their spiritual practice. Mm. And my mother had spoken about it ever since I was a little girl. She always presented it to me as, you know, taboo because you know, the sacrifices and whatnot, but it left a really vibrant and indelible impression on my mother, the ancestral pull that they had. She never really voiced her opinions in that regard about the ancestors, but my mother always speaks of, hearing certain voices from her past. She certainly recognizes smells from her mother and her father. And so she recognizes that her ancestors are around her all the time.
I talk to my ancestors that have passed on a daily basis now. I feel like they're with me all the time. Do you have any signs like that signal to you that it's the person?
I mean, my grandma Marie is around quite a bit. I honor her. You've talked about her. I wear her earrings every single day.
Yep.
Vivi would recognize, once I mentioned Grandma Marie, she, as soon as she could speak, I know this is going to sound way wackadoodle, but in one of our older homes, when Vivi was super little, she had a lighting fixture with a fan on the ceiling of her bedroom. And one of the lights would always spark and kind of on and off. Didn't matter if we changed the light bulb, didn't matter if we went to LED. And when Vivi would talk to Grandma Marie or recognize that light bulb as a way of communicating, the two of them would talk. That lighting fixture and my daughter would communicate. And I believed whether that was she was protected, that my grandmother was watching over her, that my grandmother was trying to make herself known. You know, I know that she wasn't part of that inanimate object, but I think there was a spiritual dialogue happening through the flicker of that light.
I completely, but we had an experience with a light fixture on my father when he passed. We had a lot of things happen in this house when my dad passed. Seb was not born yet. And Michael and I weren't even married yet.
Oh, wow.
And we would come. My father, of course, loved The Sopranos. And one day we were out, like we were watching The Sopranos on DVD. This was when you watched DVDs. And there was some Italian phrase that went on and I was chuckling. And Michael's like, I don't even understand. And I'm like, of course you don't, Irish guy. And he's like, oh, yeah, oh, it's so Italian. And all of a sudden, like the closet would go click and open. And we have those little knobs, like the very old fashioned, you have to pull the thing up for the thing to latch up and move.
Yes. Yeah.
And stuff like that would happen all the time. And so one morning we were out hiking, we came back and Michael was like, did you put the TV on upstairs? And I was like, no. And we went upstairs and the TV was on and the DVD player was on and it was playing The Sopranos. And Mike's like, God, your father is watching The Sopranos in the house while we're gone. And then the light fixture in the hallway has four bulbs and one would never turn off. You turn the light switch off and that one would turn on. And then you turn the light switch on and that one would turn off. And I had electricians here and they were like, I have no idea why this is happening. And there were many, many things that happened that were so clearly it was my dad. And then finally I went to like an energy worker and she was like, your father has work to do and he's down here messing around. So I think I'm going to send him off to do his work. And I was like, okay. We had this crazy thing happen where my father had a handicap thing for his car.
Sure.
But he got it illegally. Okay. My father was not handicapped. So he would pull it out when he wanted to park somewhere and he would hang it on the mirror. And I'd be like, Dad, you can't do that. And he's like, well, I got it. It's perfectly fine. I'll be 10 minutes and drove me insane. So when he died, my brother took it and he would put it on his fish truck in front of the store. And I would say, what is wrong with you guys? Like, that's just wrong. So one day we're all in the fish store. And talking about the different experiences, like little things that we've had that were like, is Dad like haunting all of us? And my brother was like, Dad wouldn't be messing around with your lights and your washing machines and all that. If Dad was going to come back, he'd make a big statement, big. And we were like, really? Like how big? And he's like, it would be a huge statement. Like there was no denying it was him. And my cousin goes, like, would he set your truck on fire? And Michael goes, exactly. And my cousin goes, your truck's on fire. We turned around, the cabin of his truck was on fire and the parking sticker was in flames. And we were like, okay, he's totally here.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's amazing.
And that's the truth, like a true story. It was hysterical.
I believe the energies remain. I believe the energies circle us, protect us, warn us. Again, it's just about paying attention. You have to be, like the gentleman said, you got to be still enough to actually ask for help and then listen. Yeah. I want to get back to Lilius though, because I really do feel strongly about what I said. And I really hope she took it in the right way. That it can be written, a part can be written, dialogue can be written on the page that you think, okay, this is how it aligns with and services the play or the character. She comes in and she is just Again, that force. She's going to change it the way that is authentically her. It makes it better. It makes it more impactful, makes it more joyous or more shocking or more lively. I don't know. She's like a spice cabinet. You know what I mean? She's got all the spices. Yeah, it's just what spices do you put in the dish? But you walk away going, oh, I didn't know it was going to taste like that. But oh my God, it's so good.
Yeah, she's amazing.
And I got to tell you, doing 8 shows a week at my age is taxing.
That's
taxing, exhausting. I don't know how I'm going to get through the next show. We always do. The magic of show business and the black box gets you through. The audience gets you through. But I don't want to say at that age because it's a number. But the life that she's lived, what the body has been put through, the spirit's been through, the voice has been put through.
Yeah.
But she's stronger than ever.
Yeah. She really is a force of nature. And funny.
Would you want to? Let's say you're 72 years old and you're being offered an incredible part on Broadway for 8 shows a week. Is that something that you would embrace or does that not feel right to you?
No, I would do it. I sort of see it the way my mom sees it. Like, you just keep moving. You keep moving. You keep saying yes. You keep trying new things. You just do it. I mean, I don't think I could do it for a year at that. You know, my knees hurt so much and whatnot, but I would certainly jump in for 6 months or whatever.
Totally.
I mean, I do think, like, you know, 70 is the new 50.
I agree.
Not, there is no, especially as we get older, people like 72 seemed so old to me. Now she just feels like a peer, you know?
That's right.
You know? Yeah. Anyway, this was awesome.
Awesome. So glad we had this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Love you.
Love you too. Bye. Stage's podcast is produced by Stephanie J. Block and Mary Lee Fairbanks in association with iHeartRadio. It can be heard on the iHeartRadio podcast and iHeartRadio Broadway or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Please join our cast by signing up at stagespodcast.net, listening, sharing, and leaving a 5-star review. It all makes such a difference in getting the word out. Thanks for listening, and we will see you again soon.